Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the program, in our handful of quick conversations on this Friday, we'll mark the Parkland anniversary, that grim anniversary, by talking with the president and co-founder of March for Our Lives Iowa, coming up in just a few minutes. Also, Jason Clayworth, the investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register, tells us about a tax violation by Senator Joni Ernst, all coming up later in the hour. But first, let's start off by checking in with IPR state government reporter Katerina Sestarek. Hi, Katerina.
Hi, Ben.
Let's run through some developments at the State House. There are a number of them. Tell us, first of all, about some changes or some proposals, I guess, in the public assistance programs that's being debated.
In the Senate this week, senators were discussing several proposals that would change, it could change who qualifies for public assistance programs like food assistance, also called SNAP, Medicaid, which is government-funded health insurance for poor and disabled Iowans and others. And so two of these proposals have to do with food assistance. One would require paying child support to qualify for food assistance. Another requires certain people to participate in job training or similar programs to qualify. There seems to be some confusion among people involved in that about who that would actually apply to. But Republicans in the Senate advanced those past the first legislative hurdles. And then another one that advanced would require Iowans on public assistance programs to have their status verified at least every 3 months, so that people, the idea is that people who aren't eligible would be detected sooner. And this would also likely involve contracting with a private company to provide data to the state to do this. And there are a lot of questions about how much this would cost and how it could likely lead to vulnerable people losing their needed benefits. And then a fourth proposal would require some Medicaid recipients to work 20 hours per week to keep receiving that government health coverage. And that was tabled because lawmakers wanted to see some statistics on that first.
Okay, a whole bunch of proposals having to do with public assistance programs, welfare, we also call it. But so these being put forth, obviously, by the Republicans who have the majority in both chambers of the Iowa legislature. What are the Democrats saying here?
Well, first, all four of these proposals were actually submitted by a lobbying group that's associated with the conservative think tank. So that lobby group, Americans for Prosperity and Iowans for Tax Relief, are registered in favor. And then there's a whole lot of people representing low-income families, children, domestic violence victims, religious groups, and some medical organizations who spoke out against these proposals. There's Republican Senator Jason Schultz was running all of these bills. He was sort of saying that these are geared at the perception that some people have that there's a lot of waste and fraud in public assistance programs, and he's trying to find out if that's true, he says. Democrats did not vote to advance any of these proposals, and they were just saying that there are a lot of concerns about how vulnerable people who need these benefits would be affected.
The governor, Governor Kim Reynolds, making a proposal to allow Iowans to bypass a doctor to get birth control. Tell us about that.
Right. Her proposal would allow Iowans 18 and older to get some forms of birth control directly from a pharmacist without having to go to a clinic first. And it also requires insurance to cover it, which for a lot of advocates is an important part. Pharmacists would have to get training. And if there's anything concerning in the patient's health history, they would then have to go to a doctor before receiving any of these contraceptives. As of this morning, the proposal still hasn't been read in as a bill at the State House, but the text of it has kind of been floating around. So I talked with some lawmakers about it this week. Mm-hmm. Representative Shannon Lundgren is the Republican in charge of the House Human Resources Committee. So this proposal would have to go through her. And she said that they're carefully considering the proposal because it is a priority of the governor. And I also talked to Democratic Representative Beth Wessel-Crichel. She says it's a good first step and Democrats are definitely open to it. But she still has concerns about access to other family planning services.
Mm-hmm. Ethics has been a big topic of news for more than a year at the Iowa legislature, and you heard some conversations about the changes in Senate ethics rules. Tell us about those.
So the Senate removed the statute of limitations for filing ethics complaints. It was previously a 3-year limit on when a complaint could be filed against a senator. And the changes also tie into a Senate harassment prevention policy that applies now to a senator's conduct outside of the state house. And when they're not performing official duties, they're also prohibited from harassing people. And so this appears to be linked to Senator Nate Bolton, a Democrat, who had an ethics complaint against him. But then the ethics committee dismissed it because it happened outside of the Capitol and before he was a senator.
Mm. Katerina, let's talk a little bit about what we'll go in depth in on Monday's program. The way judges are nominated in our state.
Yes, there's a proposal that was advanced by out of a Senate committee this week. It's also moving in the House. It would change how judges and justices on the Iowa Supreme Court are selected. And basically right now there has been fiery debate between some Republican and Democratic senators where the Republicans are saying that this is a way to make the process more fair, to make it more accountable to voters, and to perhaps even get better judges in to the system. And Democrats are saying that it's a power grab and that it's just because Republicans are unhappy with some recent court rulings.
I'm saying it's a power grab, and Democrats warning that this would turn out to make it a more partisan judicial system, right?
Right.
Okay. We'll explore that Monday. A couple of our guests will be talking with Senator Julian Garrett, Republican, and Senator Rob Hoge of Cedar Rapids. Tune in Monday. Katerina and I will be co-hosting that program on Monday. Until then, Katerina, have a great weekend.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, on Wednesday of this week, a jury of Iowans ruled that an Iowa prison warden discriminated against a transgender employee by denying him the use of the men's restrooms and locker rooms. It's a verdict that advocates are calling historic. Historic since the lawsuit was the first transgender rights case to be filed in Iowa District Court since Iowa added gender identity protections to the Iowa Civil Rights Act. That was back in 2007. These jurors also found that the state executive branch discriminated against this employee by offering medical benefits that would not cover his gender reassignment surgery. Now, after making those findings, the 8-member jury awarded $120,000 in damages for emotional distress. Joining me now, the winning plaintiff in this case, Jesse Vrew, a 37-year-old former nurse at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women in Mitchellville. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Describe the moment for you when you heard this ruling.
When I heard the, I was so excited. I couldn't believe it. I was speechless. I was so proud of my fellow Iowans and the jury for looking at the evidence of the case and ruling on my behalf.
Walk us through the events and how you got to the point of taking legal action. Tell us in these two points what happened.
So I was very open with my employer, the Department of Corrections, that I was undergoing a transition process from being female to male, and communicated through my chain of command, my supervisor. And over the course of a year, I had several communications, you know, wanting to putting them on notice that I would want to see a policy in place and to be able to use the male restrooms and locker rooms. And unfortunately, I think it was about 10 months passed by, and I was finally informed by the warden that I would not be able to have these accommodations. And that's when I filed a complaint with the ACLU against the state of Iowa.
You because you were transitioning from female to male, you wanted to switch restrooms at a certain point. You gave them notice. And how did they respond in denying you the use of the male bathroom in this case?
The medical director of the Department of Corrections at the time and the warden also, they were concerned more about of the other male staff members, and then they felt that due to the media attention at the time that the issue was too controversial.
Too controversial.
Yes.
Okay. The other aspect of this is that you were denied health care coverage by your employer. Tell us that story.
So I was seeking gender affirmative surgery or a chest reconstruction from female to male chest. And I had gone through the process of contacting Wellmark and seeing what plan I could be covered under that would cover my necessary care. And I also contacted the HR department at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women who referred me back to Wellmark. But to make a long story short, really, I ended up finding out that the state, I had three plans to choose from, and unfortunately, the state had that discrimination clause in all three of their policies.
Mm-hmm. So this was the discrimination, according to this lawsuit, was in Wellmark's corner or the Iowa Department of Corrections?
I believe the Iowa Department of Corrections, it's considered a self-funded contract for health insurance. So it was actually the Department of Administrative Services who had that discrimination. Mm-hmm. There.
And at what point did you decide in that to take legal action, that you were ready to do that?
Well, I had met, I had contacted one Iowan who hooked me up with the ACLU, and going through and discussing things with them, and the state wasn't assisting me getting the coverage I needed, that's when we decided to file the lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. You no longer work for your former employer, the Department of Corrections here in Iowa. How did that come to an end?
That's something that I'm going to keep quiet for now. That may come out in the future.
Okay. Was this ruling by a jury a surprise to you or those who were on your side?
I was fairly confident that they would rule in my favor for the restroom locker room issue. I wasn't as confident about the health insurance because the state was pointing fingers at both the union and Wellmark themselves. But so I was surprised at the insurance.
Mm-hmm. Transgender is, I don't have to tell you this, that's a term that is often misunderstood. What can you tell us, tell Iowa Public Radio listeners about your journey as a transgender person, I guess to help those of us who might not quite get it yet, to help us better understand?
Sure. So everybody is born with a gender identity. And for most people, for a greater percent of the population, your gender identity, which is your internal identity, matches your physical identity.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, my internal identity is male, and I was born female, so it was incongruent. It didn't match. So it's kind of like wearing a Halloween costume. So on the inside, you know who you are, but to the world outside, you appear different. That's how I describe it.
Mm-hmm.
And my journey actually started when I was in third grade up until the present time.
In third grade, you were biologically a female, but you knew then that you were a male inside.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Hmm. Jesse, tell us, what do you hope this ruling will mean for other members of the trans community in Iowa and across the nation? This is historic, as I mentioned.
Right. Well, for one, I think it's very notable to say that, you know, the state is not above holding up the law, and they are not above the law, so they needed to be held accountable. And for equality, not only in Iowa, but throughout the entire United States and hopefully the world, that discrimination is not acceptable and it will not be tolerated. And basically, you know, I've helped, you know, pave the path that people can start walking down.
Mm-hmm. Were there any times in the case of this process, a long process, I imagine, where you thought it's just not worth it?
I never had that thought. I'm very persistent. I knew that they had treated me wrong and it wasn't fair. And in the back of my mind, I kept thinking about those people who don't have a voice or those who don't have the opportunity to speak up for other people.
Mm-hmm. And you had a support, One Iowa, you mentioned, also other support as well.
Yes, One Iowa, the ACLU, and my attorney, Melissa Hasso, and her team.
All right. Jessie Vrew, 37-year-old former nurse at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women in Mitchellville, he won a lawsuit this week that transgender rights advocates are calling historic. Jessie Vrew, thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, sir.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday, you had to hear it, we marked the one-year anniversary of the massacre inside a Florida school, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where a former student with an assault gun killed 17 people a year ago yesterday, February 14th, 2018. Students and families leading a nationwide push for school and gun safety paused yesterday to mark that anniversary of the deadliest U.S. high school shooting. Kevin Drejas joins me now. He's a Linmar High School student, a senior, also president and co-founder of March for Our Lives, Iowa. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you mark yesterday?
Yeah, so yesterday I was working actually up at the state capitol, so I didn't have a lot of time to do a lot of advocacy, and a lot of yesterday was spent mourning the 17 lives lost and remembering my friends down in Parkland and all the emotional trauma they've been through this week. So a lot of it was remembering those lives and spending that time thinking about those friends. And we are spending the next few days as an organization staying quiet on social media to take time to mourn those lives.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was a very sad and somber day.
Remind us, what is March for Our Lives, Iowa specifically, and how did it get started in Iowa?
Yeah, so March for Our Lives, Iowa actually started a couple weeks after the Parkland shooting last year. And so we, you know, the ball got rolling with the walkouts that happened last year. There were multiple all over the state. And, you know, the ball kind of rolled on from there. We had a big town hall with 13 candidates, one of the first midterm candidate forums, and where we talked about gun violence, mental health issues, criminal justice reform, everything that deals with gun violence. And then we had another forum later in June with Parkland students. And from there, a few friends and I got together and said, you know, we need to keep this movement going. And so Clinton Gay and Olivia Kennedy, both students at Washington High School, and myself officially formed March for Our Lives Iowa nonprofit in July after doing a little bit of planning. And since then, we've had a few events and gotten a few things accomplished. But the main mission of our organization is to promote gun violence prevention and also civic youth engagement in civics and their community. And so we've been very successful with that. And you've seen the national movement all over, not just in the state. And it's been an astonishing and amazing time planning these events and working.
What changes are you looking for first and foremost, specifically in terms of legislation?
Yeah. So our organization is really looking for these bipartisan pieces of legislation to pass. So we're looking at things like extreme risk protection orders. And this is a bill that has been filed by Representative Art Staid at the State House. And so this actually allows family members and close friends of individuals to go to court and say, you know, I know a certain person, they pose a risk to themselves or others. And, you know, these people are the family members or friends are allowed to present a burden of proof showing that this person has harmed someone else or themselves. And if the judge rules that, yes, they are, they can have their firearms taken away for a year and reevaluated. And so that we really think is a bipartisan piece of legislation to make sure that we are keeping firearms away from individuals who are posing a threat.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also are. Sorry, go for it.
No, I just wanted to make sure we're short of time. We have about 3 minutes left. I wanted to ask you about that. Do you feel you have bipartisan support? Because gun rights advocates here in Iowa are pushing proposals through the legislature that could loosen some Iowa gun laws. You know that.
Yes. So, I mean, honestly, we don't feel like we have bipartisan support quite yet. And that's something we're really trying to work on. Universal background checks, you've seen it on the federal level. We're trying to also advocate for that on the state level as well. and really get bipartisan support around that. But when it comes to things like extreme risk protection orders and safe storage laws, we don't feel like we have that support, especially since the GOP and Republican lawmakers have been trying and recently announced they are going to try and dismantle safety courses and those permits and licenses for firearm owners.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you saw this poll, a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll found that the urgency for new gun restrictions has declined since Parkland. Right after Parkland, 71% of Americans, according to this poll, said laws covering the sale of firearms should be stricter. That's dropped now to 51% saying laws should be stricter. That is not where you intend this trend to be going, is it? How do you explain that?
No, and so that is something we're really trying to, address right now, because we do want to keep that momentum going. And so there's a couple things that we can attribute to that. First of all, elections are over, and so we don't have candidates addressing that issue all the time. And we do have the GOP and Republican lawmakers at the State House advocating for looser gun restrictions, which I'm sure has a lot of people steering the other way. And then just in general, a lot of the urgency behind these issues has dropped, and people have gotten a little bit tired from, from all the advocacy that has been going on. And that's something we're trying to keep up. And we found ways that we can keep that up and keep the advocacy and activism going behind the subject. And that's something our organization is working to address. And we do have a few ideas and events in place to try and bring back the momentum behind this issue. But we have noticed that too. That the motivation has been slipping a little bit. But nevertheless, we are persisting, and people around the state are continuing to stay motivated, especially the youth population.
Mm-hmm. How many are involved in your organization, March for Our Lives, Iowa?
Yeah, so we have hundreds of volunteers and a couple dozen on our leadership team. And it is all student-run, so all of our leadership, our board members, everything are students. And we do have a tremendous amount of adult support and support around the state. But we do have a couple hundred volunteers and guests at all of our events, which is amazing.
Okay, so in the 30 seconds we have remaining for you, tell us, what do you have planned for upcoming events?
Yeah, so we just announced yesterday we're partnering with Progress Iowa and Interfaith Iowa to have the March for Our Lives rallies again on Sunday the 24th around the state at multiple locations. We also are planning a March for Our Lives Advocacy Day on the Hill. So coming up in a month or a few weeks, we will be having students come to the Hill to advocate for gun sense legislation. And then we're also planning a big Dance for Our Lives, where we're bringing influencers and popular music artists from around the nation to bring students together to have a good time and learn about networking and advocacy.
Okay, Kevin Drejas, Lynn Mar High School senior, president and co-founder of March for Our Lives Iowa. Thank you for your time, Kevin.
Thank you so much.
When we continue, I'll talk with Jason Clayworth of the Des Moines Register. He'll tell us about a tax violation by Senator Joni Ernst. Also, plenty more in the second half of this News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Our quick conversations on this Friday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Virtual desktop, virtual assistant, virtual space. That is a word, virtual, that describes more and more of the things that make up our lives. And now that descriptor may be added to the Iowa caucuses, at least as an option. Clay Masters is with me, Iowa Public Radio reporter and, of course, Morning Edition host. Hi, Clay.
Good afternoon.
So what's going on?
Well, the first major changes to the Iowa Democratic caucuses were announced earlier this week. So basically, anyone who takes part in the first-in-the-nation presidential nominating process here in Iowa would be able, under these rules from the Iowa Democratic Party, to do so virtually if the proposal is approved by both a central party committee and the Democratic National Committee.
Okay, virtually. So how would that work in practice, or are details still being worked out?
Of course, every Iowan who pays attention to politics knows that Iowa Democrats have had to physically attend the caucuses, filling gymnasiums and different locations to declare their choices. They've done it since 1972. Well, critics have often, as you know full well, they've said that, you know, this excludes people who maybe serve in the military or have a disability or work or childcare restraints. So they, you know, it leaves naturally some people out from participating. So the DNC put forth, you know, you need to basically said you need to change some things about the caucuses a couple years ago. And this is what Democrats have unveiled. And there is a 30-day period in which they're seeking public comment. So the clock's already ticking on that. But basically, there will be six of these virtual caucuses, and people will literally just have to call in at the prescribed time and express their presidential preferences. At least that's how they're selling the idea from the Iowa Democratic Party.
Okay, so you've been to caucuses. I've been to caucuses in gymnasiums or classrooms or wherever they happen, Clay. So I'm trying to picture how this will be integrated. We'll see. But you talked to the Iowa Democratic Party chairman, Troy Price, about this. What did you want to find out from him?
Yeah, so right after the announcement came out, I set up a time to head over to the Democratic Party's state office here in Des Moines and went over there, spoke with him. And I mean, the first thing is they were unveiling this on the call that they had with reporters. It just sounded confusing to me. Mm. And so basically—
The caucus is confusing?
Yeah, exactly.
Come on, well, and, Clay.
And that was one of my first questions to him was, you know, are you concerned that this is going to make the process more confusing? And he said, contrary to that, well, we'll hear a little bit of what he had to say.
See, I actually think that it's going to make the process easier. Adding virtual caucuses actually just gives more people a chance to have their voices heard. And it's a fairly easy way to do so. They just literally have to call in, so long as they're registered with the party and a registered Democrat. They literally just have to call in at the prescribed time and express their presidential preferences. This is a real opportunity for us to streamline the process. And there's going to be even more stuff coming out as we work through our plans in the coming months.
Okay, so Clay, I guess we'll see if Troy Price... his description there that it will be easier comes true in the coming months. What happens next?
What happens next? Again, they have to get approval from the DNC and the State Central Committee, and they are seeking public input for another 25 days or so. But I also want to just piggyback on the challenges that this creates. I did call up Rachel Payne Caulfield, Drake University political science professor, appears on Politics Wednesday a lot on this show.
We love Rachel.
Just to get her insight. And she said, you know, the nature of virtual participation is really not yet well articulated in terms of the user experience. And Rachel had said, you know, when you introduce a big change like this, there will be some level of confusion and some level of difficulty just navigating what the options are and then making sure that you can participate in person or virtually. So I think the details are going to continue to be ironed out here in the days and months in the lead up to the Iowa caucuses. I say days like it's soon, but it is still quite a ways away.
It is quite a ways away, but we are definitely firmly footed in caucus season. You can tell by the number of candidates coming by through Iowa. Clay, I want to talk a little bit about the Republican side of this. Of course, the last time in 2016 when we had the caucuses, there was a huge field of Republican candidates eventually settling on Donald Trump. But where do they come in this picture in terms of virtual caucusing? Have they weighed in?
The Republicans really haven't weighed in too much about the virtual caucuses. I haven't seen any release on that. But, you know, Republicans and Democrats are regularly united about Iowa keeping its first in the nation caucuses. And I should note, too, that it was actually Senator Ted Cruz that won the Iowa caucuses back in 2016, not Donald Trump. He came in second. But Republicans will still have some kind of a caucus, just like the Democrats did when President Barack Obama was up for re-election in 2012. And there are some questions out there as to whether or not he will be challenged. The most recent Iowa poll published in December of last year said that Republicans in the state are strongly supportive of President Donald Trump, but they also welcome people who might want to make their pitch to Iowans. And so Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, who's been a critic of the president, he's going to be here next month for a Republican Governors Association meeting. And we've also, you know, over the last couple years heard rumblings that maybe there'd be a challenge from Ohio's John Kasich or maybe Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse. So we'll continue to keep an eye on the Republican side, too, even with all this massive amount of Democrats running
okay.
on their side.
many months of caucus coverage to come. We're glad that you're there for us to interpret it and report on it. Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this week we learned that Iowa's junior senator, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, repaid almost $1,900 for a tax break that she had claimed on her Washington, D.C. condo going back to 2016. The problem, she also simultaneously claimed a similar tax break here in Iowa. Her office said her claim of the homestead tax credit in Washington was an error, and she rectified it with a check. She wrote that check last Friday, 2 days after the Des Moines Register inquired about the matter. Jason Clayworth is with us. He's been on this story. He's an investigative reporter with the Des Moines Register. Hi again, Jason.
Hello, Ben. Good afternoon.
Where did this story start for you?
We were contacted by a research group that says that it's committed to holding Republicans accountable. It's known as American Bridge. And they came to us and they pointed out what appeared to be authentic records, public records, and were authentic public records, showed that Senator Ernst had simultaneously benefited from the homestead tax exemption in two states.
Mm-hmm. So explain that the error that she made in taxes. Also, is this an elementary error or nuanced, you know, complicated tax code?
Sure. Well, the homestead exemption is for people whose primary residence is in a particular state. And in Iowa and D.C. specifically, you can't simultaneously claim these credits. That was the issue. And whether or not this was, a relatively simple error, it's something that occurs relatively frequently. D.C. itself has its own sub-office that reviews these types of issues. And in the past few years, they have collected millions of dollars that were not supposed to have been savings that were not supposed to have been collected by folks. So it does appear to be a relatively common type of error.
Mm-hmm. So you took the information from American Bridge that you were given, you checked it out. Talk about the approach to Senator Ernst's office after you checked it out. How did they react?
Well, Senator Ernst acted quickly. We contacted her on a Wednesday, and by a Friday, she had refunded the money. Their office did not give a lengthy explanation of what happened. They acknowledged that it was an error, and her office gave us copies of the letter that she sent to the Tax and Revenue Department in Washington, D.C. And so we know that she acted quickly, and presumably that is the first that she had realized what had transpired.
Mm-hmm. I assume you asked them to explain, Senator Ernst, to explain the error. Did they do that?
Just that an error had occurred. And so, I mean, how specifically it happened, I don't know. We just don't know that answer at this point. I know, though, from other stories that I've covered that sometimes when folks are purchasing a property, you have forms put in front of you, and anybody that's purchased a home can probably relate. It's almost like it's a signature fatigue type issue. It's possible that something like that happened, and maybe that's likely. We just don't know at this point, but it is again something that has happened before, and there have been other people in the political world that have done have committed very similar errors, including our former candidate for governor, Fred Hubbell. So it's happened, it's happened before. This is not a unique circumstance.
Right. And as you point out in your story, Fred Hubbell took a raking over by Republicans for taking that same homestead deduction in two states. He was fined, right?
He was. $600. It was a county auditor in the state of Arizona who fined him. He had simultaneously collected the tax exemption in both states. And so, you know, again, this is not necessarily a unique problem, but for somebody that's in a political office, they tend to set the example. And so, you know, that it makes headlines when that situation occurs.
How is this infraction, this error classified? Could it be seen as tax fraud?
Well, certainly, if it depends on who you ask. When, you know, when Mr. Hubble was running for governor, there some of his political opponents likened it to tax fraud. And we saw, you know, in this past week that some of Senator Ernst's folks that are against her politically have made, you know, similar type of comments. So tax fraud, I think that might be, well, I'm not sure. I just don't know. I think it depends on who you ask, and it definitely is an error that occurred, and there are definitely, in some cases, fines and penalties that can occur that. You could spend some time in jail even. So it definitely is a serious issue and taken seriously by tax officials.
Mm-hmm. But we don't know in this case what Senator Ernst may face from the IRS, the tax office.
Yeah, we just don't know that.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that's a follow-up for you on this story. I don't know if you have any thoughts on the political ramifications. You mentioned the political operatives certainly taking note of this for the 2020 race, right?
Well, any time that there are errors in somebody's tax filings, that becomes fodder in election cycles. We've seen that time and time again, and this is likely no exception. We probably will hear about this in the election cycle. That wouldn't be a surprise. Whether or not voters believe that this was something that was done purposely and how it will truly affect her in the race is yet to be seen. In the situation where, you know, we're talking about something that, again, has happened commonly in other situations, and we know that just because of the what D.C. itself and its office that reviews homestead exemptions has accomplished. So we know that it's not unique.
Okay, Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter with the Des Moines Register. Thank you very much, Jason.
Thank you.
And we're coming to the end of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa will soon see an uptick in overdose deaths from heroin and synthetic opioids such as fentanyl. Well, that's a prediction drawn from a new study from Iowa State University. David Peters is with us in our Ames studio, Associate Professor of Rural Sociology at ISU. Good afternoon to you, David.
Good afternoon, Ben.
We have just a few minutes, a lot of facets to this study, but let's get to some of the highlights. A new study you did together with a colleague, Andrew Hochstetler. Maybe I'm giving it too much of a German pronunciation there. You probably say Hochstetler. Hochstetler, a professor of sociology and criminology there with you. Also, Peter Miller, an undergraduate research assistant in sociology. We've been hearing how stronger regulation, efforts to prescribe fewer opioids have helped reduce overdose deaths in Iowa. Now you're telling us we have a worrying future to look forward to in a couple of years.
Yep.
How is that?
Yeah, so that's right. So better regulation of prescription opioids has resulted in a decline in deaths from these prescription opioids in Iowa and nationally. But what we see is that people are switching, users and addicts are switching away from the prescription drugs to illicit opioids like heroin and synthetics that are not regulated by state government, aren't prescribed by physicians. So it's turned away from a epidemic that's been caused by legal prescription drugs away from that to one that looks more like a typical drug problem with illegal opioids.
And fentanyl is coming into our common usage here as a drug. This is an incredibly powerful drug, right?
Yeah, right. So just for reference, your typical oxycodone pill is 5 to 10 times more potent than morphine, and fentanyl, the synthetic opioid, is 100 times more potent than morphine. So
wow.
That's why you're seeing the big spike in overdose deaths nationally and in our surrounding states in Illinois, Missouri, and Wisconsin, is because people are dying from fentanyl exposure.
Mm-hmm. So specifically to Iowa, explain a little bit more in detail your predictions over the next few years and why.
Right. So I believe that right now, total opioid overdose deaths are stable in the state, but I believe that in the next that this is only a temporary lull in that death rate, that we'll see that increase as prescription opioid deaths fall, and we see a steady increase since 2012 of heroin deaths and deaths from synthetic opioids and a mix of both heroin and synthetics together. And those are trending strongly upward in Iowa, and eventually they'll overtake prescription overdose deaths and will become more like the rest of the country and our surrounding states that have seen this big spike in opioid deaths from illegal substances like heroin and synthetics.
Right. And you said these are illicit drugs. Yep. Isn't there any way to, through law enforcement, better law enforcement, to stop this? Isn't that a factor?
It will be a factor. Now, drug intelligence networks, regional drug task forces, working with federal agencies, specifically like DEA, is important to stem this influx of illegal drugs. Now, Iowa is in a unique position that we have a little bit of breathing room right now. We don't see very high heroin and synthetic deaths relative to the rest of the country. And so now is the time for the state of Iowa and law enforcement to work together to try to stop the importation of these illegal drugs into our communities, you know, before it becomes a problem.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting in your study, too. You are a rural sociologist. Right. The difference between opioid addiction in urban versus rural areas in Iowa. Speak briefly to that.
Right. So in rural Iowa, it's almost primarily prescription drugs. And the reason for that is that's what's available. Almost every community or every county has a pharmacy. They're much easier to obtain. By contrast, heroin and synthetic opioids are trafficked through criminal organizations, and those tend to locate in our larger cities. And also, it's an east-west issue. So the eastern side of Iowa is beginning to have a very strong heroin problem. We think that's spillover from Chicago, mm-hmm. whereas the west side of the state, it's almost absent. It's only prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm. And you also looked at the connections here, if any, with crime rates. What did you find?
Well, we found that there wasn't much. We found that, surprisingly, you know, typically when there's a drug problem, typically violent crime and property crime increases, and we didn't see that in Iowa, that really there was no real difference in crime rates in our rural communities.
Mm-hmm. But prescription drugs are still a gateway here, and it's interesting in your study that you see that prescription drug abusers see themselves differently than non-prescription drug, illegal drug users, right?
Yeah, because So typically the main way that people enter into opioid addiction is through work. And so in Iowa, the counties with the highest prescription overdose death rates have large numbers of people working in the types of jobs that generate a lot of workplace injuries, manufacturing, transportation, warehousing, utilities. And so they get an injury at work, they're prescribed prescription opioids, they take that over a period of time and they get addicted. But it's different because, one, they're obtaining them legally. And secondly, it's associated with work. And so they're taking pills to continue working, mm-hmm. or their injury was begotten from work, as opposed to the illegal drug user where, you know, there's no real medical reason to take those illegal substances.
David Peters, I'm so glad this is part of a five-year initiative that you are leading, because we'll talk about this again in the future. You're leading a team of researchers at ISU, the University of Iowa, and Syracuse University. We'll talk later about the next steps and what you discover. Fascinating work. David Peters, Associate Professor of Rural Sociology at Iowa State University.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, let's groove into the weekend with Mark Simmet, Studio One Tracks host. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
What do you got for us?
Well, we have an album from a band called Mercury Rev from upstate New York. It's brand new. You remember Bobby Gentry and her song Ode to Billy Joe?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she's known for that song pretty much exclusively. After that, she made an album that didn't do nearly as well for her called The Delta Suite in 1968. And this band, in a true indie rock style, Mercury Rev, have revived this album, done their own version of all the songs with a variety of female vocalists joining them. And it's just a great listen. It's got a lot of Bobby Gentry original songs, more of her southern narratives, just like Ode to Billy Joe, and also some cover songs. We're going to hear one of the cover songs. It's Tobacco Road.
Okay, on our way out, Tobacco Road. Do listen to Studio One Tracks host Mark Simmet and Tony Daner, the others on Studio One. Our Studio One service just great, especially on the weekend. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome, Ben. My pleasure.
Tobacco Road.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Lulu Dewey. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Groove into the weekend and have a great one. Take care until next week.